This April 22nd, 9 a.m., the Upper District Board of Directors. And at this time, did you want to say your comments now, Tom?
Yes, Chairman. Okay. So for those logging on through Zoom, please, if you would like to make public comment, use the raise your hand feature that is available on Zoom. We will keep the microphones for the board members, legal counsel, and the general manager open. The rest of the microphones will be muted until the time comes for public comment or you raise your hand on a particular agenda item. Those on the phone, you would please, if you would like to make public comment, send an email to christy@usgvmwd.org. That is posted on the agenda. You can see that information there. Or communicate with us another way if you'd like to make public comment. When we get to the standard public comment, we will open all microphones for a period of time to see if there's anyone, whether they can raise their hand or not, will be able to make public comment. So that concludes my administrative discussion, Director.
Okay, and as well as I also have a opened up a screen where I could see people who raised their hands, even those people that are on the on other lines there. So I can see that as well. So if anybody has a question, could also raise their hand and I could identify you as well. So with that said, let's go ahead and go to the agenda. Item number one is the Pledge of Allegiance. And if staff could get that all queued up for us.
Yeah, it's ready to go. Here we go.
Thank you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Excellent. We tried that last meeting, didn't work out, but we got it all queued up now. Thank you, Ruben, for that.
You're welcome, sure.
We'll go to item number two, roll call of the board of directors, and I will get a roll call. So if you're here, please mention that. Director Santana?
Here.
Director Fellow?
Here.
Director Trevino?
Here.
Director Contreras?
Here.
And Director Chavez is here. So let the record show that all members are present. Item number three is the adoption of the agenda. Is there a motion? Bye.
So moved.
Second.
It's a motion by Trevino, seconded by Fellow. Any questions? Hearing none, then all those in favor, again, roll call.
Roll call vote, please.
Yes. Santana?
Aye.
Fellow?
Aye.
Trevino?
Aye.
Contreras?
Aye.
And Chavez, aye. The adoption of the agenda has been approved, 5-0. We'll go to public comments. All those that are on that wish to participate in public comments may do so. Please let me know or raise your hand.
And good morning, President Chavez and Board of Directors. This is Christy with the Executive Assistant. No other public comments have been received to date.
I appreciate it. I see Tony from Watermaster raising their hands. Tony, do you wish to make public comments?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out there's an item later on that talks about PFAS on the basin. And I had talked to Tom earlier in the week. Watermaster has had Stetson working on the samples that we've done in the basin, and we have a memo that will be going out in the board packet that talks about the wells that have been sampled by us and the results. I didn't want to butt into the presentation, and frankly, half the time on this thing, I get it wrong anyway and hit the wrong button. So I just wanted to let you know that we haven't put that memo on the street yet because I wanted you, the board, to see it first, and then we will be distributing it to the other managers and eventually to the Basin Water Management Committee. But it talks about results and what we think it will cost to sample every well in the basin. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, great. That's for public comments. And then just to let everybody know, we will have the presentation on that issue. And after the presentation, we'll take questions from the board, then from the public. At this time, we'll continue public comments. Anybody else wishing to speak at this time may do so.
Okay, I'm going to unmute the microphones for a few seconds. And by the way, I've unmuted on our end, but if you have your own microphone muted, it does not do that. So,
okay. One more call for public comments. If not, dispense with that item and go to item number five, committee reports. We do have one committee report in our package for government affairs, and Chairwoman Santana, did you wish to add anything to that report?
No, it looks good. We did have that meeting, I believe it was last week via Zoom. I think it went pretty smoothly. I know we have an action item coming up regarding recommended legislative positions. And I have nothing more to add.
Excellent. Any other questions from directors? If not, then we'll move to item number six, is the consent calendar. Is there a motion?
So moved.
It was moved by Director Fellow, seconded by Director Trevino. Any questions on the consent calendar?
It's fine, Marie. Don't worry.
Okay, if not, then we will take a vote. All those in favor, please say aye. Director Santana?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, we need a roll call vote.
Yes.
Please do. Okay.
Director Fellow?
Aye.
Director Trevino?
Aye.
Director Contreras?
Aye.
And Director Chavez, aye. The consent calendar is approved on a 5-0 vote. We'll go to item number seven, which is action discussion items. Letter A is approved the recommended legislative positions. This has been passed by the Government Affairs Committee and it's presented to us as a board. Is there a motion to approve those positions?
So moved by Trevino.
Second.
It's been moved by Trevino, seconded by Fellow. Any discussions on those recommendations?
I have a quick question on the consent calendar, actually. Did we address B6B?
Yes, it was the consent calendar. Okay. The consent calendar consists of A and B.
Okay, great. Perfect. Okay, that's all.
All right. So we'll continue on the recommendation. There was a motion to approve item number 7A. Any discussions on those positions? If not, we will take a vote. Director Santana?
Aye.
Director Fellow?
Aye.
Director Trevino?
Aye.
Director Contreras?
Aye.
And Director Chavez, aye. Item 7A has passed 5-0. We'll go to 7B regarding the PFAS. We do have a presentation, and Mr. Love, can you introduce our special guest?
Yes, certainly. So a number of months ago, both directors and then some of our city elected officials have asked if we could arrange for a presentation regarding the PFAS and PFOA water quality issues. And so we did make arrangements for Dr. Mick Stewart with Metropolitan Water District to present this day. This was prior to us going to remote meetings. But Dr. Stewart has been with the Metropolitan Water District since 1987 and has been the Director of Water Quality for over 20 years. His responsibilities include the administrative supervisory and research oversight for the water quality section of Metropolitan. And given that they provide supplemental water supplies to 19 million people, a pretty important job. They have over 100 engineers, chemists, microbiologists, support staff responsible for water quality and applied research programs. They also are involved in advising Metropolitan's executive staff regarding legislative and regulatory issues. And he is also a member of several professional water industry organizations and has been published in several journals. And so certainly he has a broad expertise as it relates to water quality. And I think he'll give us an excellent presentation and overview of the PFAS, PFOA issues we are facing in the water industry. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Tom. And good morning, President Chavez and members of the board. Seems like it was ages ago since Director Trevino invited me to give this presentation. A lot has changed since then. My wife was stunned when I put on a suit and tie this morning, but in the spirit of giving a board presentation, I would do no less. All right. So it's my task today to give an overview of per- and polychloroalkyl substances, or PFAS. And I've asked Ruben to advance the slide so I don't push the wrong button and lose the entire presentation. So Ruben, let's go to the next slide. This topic has certainly been of interest to a lot of media attention, a lot of headlines on that. It's been a subject of a short documentary, The Devil We Know, and also more recently, even a movie, Dark Waters. So a lot of attention in the public concerning PFAS, and you'll see later in the presentation an area of active interest for regulatory efforts. Let's go to the next slide. So just exactly what are per- and polypleural substances? Now, they're broad class of manufactured chemicals used to make products that resist heat, grease, stains, and water. Probably the one you're most familiar with is Teflon, coated cookware. It was actually first developed in the 1940s, and many of you that have followed literature on this, you probably saw earlier reports there was 3,000 to 4,000. Well, actually, there's close to almost 8,000 different PFAS that's known today. Remember, PFAS stands for per- and polychloroalkyl substances, and we'll talk about that in a moment in terms of the nomenclature. But these chemicals are very stable in the environment, and that's where they've earned the nickname forever chemicals. But they can be found in soil, air, surface waters, groundwater, wastewater, plant effluent. Basically, just about everywhere you look, you're going to find one of these chemicals. Let's go to the next slide. All right. This is my effort at trying to demystify this very long name. And I'm just going to move my screen. There we go. So what you see here in front of you is a diagram of the chemical structure of per- and polychloroalkyl substances. And the little black circles or the balls represent carbon atoms that are joined together. And when they're joined like that, that's where they come up with the term alkyl. So alkyl stands for a carbon chain. So next. And attached to the carbon atoms are fluorine atoms. That's what the little green balls are showing on this diagram. And you'll also note that I've underlined the prefix per. Per means that every carbon bonding site, except for the functional group on the far right of your slide, has a fluorine atom attached to it. And that's how you get perfluoroalkyl substances. So per means fluorine atoms attached to all bonding sites of the carbon backbone chain. Let's advance the slide one more time. And on the end is the functional group. The red balls represent oxygen, the little white ones hydrogen. So this particular structure represents perfluorooctanoic acid, also known as PFOA. And one of the nicknames for PFOA was C8. You might have seen that in literature. That stands for the fact that it has eight carbons. Now, that's not hardly that descriptive because lots of molecules have eight carbons, but that's the nickname it's earned. Let's go to the next slide. So I also mentioned there's something called polyfluoroalkyl substances. So again, they also share a common structure. Here's the carbon backbone again. Let's advance the slide. Again, they're attached with fluorine atoms to each of the carbon atoms. But if you look at the far right, you'll see that there's a carbon atom that does not have a fluorine atom attached to it. Let's advance the slide. Here, this one has two hydrogen atoms attached to it, and this is referred to as poly. Poly means that many, but not all of the carbon atoms have fluorine. I'm getting a message. My internet connection's unstable. All right, Ruben, can you advance it one more time? Are we still seeing the slides?
Yep.
We are, Mick, but the audio is breaking up a bit.
Okay. All right. If we lose entirely, I will call in on the phone. All right. So this particular structure is 8,2-fluorotoluene. Next slide. All right, so why are these important chemicals? Well, the slide titled as industrial surfactants, they have a very unique chemical structure and properties associated with them. The nonpolar fluorocarbon tail, if you look in the bottom, that's the tail piece to the left, is both hydrophobic, means it's resistant to water, and lipophobic and oleophobic, resistance to fats and oils. The polar head group, the image to the far right, the structure such as this makes it a unique chemical that aids in its ability to be waterproof, stain resistant, or non-stick material in consumer products. So that's why this chemical has such wide use and commercial applications. Let's go to the next slide. Little history of PFAS. As I said earlier, started in the 1940s. It's been around for quite a while. And you might recognize the slogan in the upper left, better things for better living through chemistry. That was a DuPont advertising slogan in 1935. And in the far right, a little image of their advertising for the first HAP can. And that they took a cast iron skillet and coated it with what's called, long name. It's a Teflon material. And that started off in really the 1940s. And since then, they've used PFAS chemicals for a wide variety of waterproofing and their purposes. So they've been around for a long, long time. Let's go to the next slide. All right. So one of the concerns with PFAS is they can bioaccumulate in humans and wildlife. And the two that's probably the most commonly used in the industry and best studied and understood is perfluorooctanoic acid, or PFOA, and perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, PFOS. Let me stop right here. Frequently when people say PFAS, sometimes they're talking about PFOS, which is one of the 8,000 different PFAS. It's a little bit confusing. So I'll refer to them as PFOA or PFOS. So remember, PFAS is the whole family of 8,000 chemicals. PFOS is just one of those 8,000. But what's interesting is that these two chemicals have been found in the blood of 95% of all people tested. That just underscores how common these things are in the environment. There was a voluntary phase-out starting in 2000. But they're still present, and exposure continues due to their presence in products from some companies that didn't participate in the voluntary phase-out, and also products imported from other countries. So you're going to see these products in the pizza box covering, the French fry wrappers. They're still being used, but there's different derivatives. Let's go to the next slide. This slide here, just as a summary of health effects, provided courtesy of Lisa Corey, Dr. Corey from Intertox. And basically, PFOA and PFOS is associated with a host of different adverse health effects. based upon animal studies and human studies. There's cancer endpoints, also non-cancer endpoints, including thyroid disease, ulcerative colitis, hypertension, just a whole host of adverse human health effects, which is why these two particular chemicals have been of such concern to the public and for health agencies. Let's go to the next slide. Because of the adverse health effects, there's been an effort by the industry to develop what's called replacement chemicals for PFOS and PFOA. And here's a couple here that's quite common. The first one's Gen X, and I've included the chemical name for those chemists that are true of heart that are listening in today. And I'm going to ask Director Trevino to repeat the name. No, I won't do that. It's a very long name, very complicated.
No, thanks.
All right. So Gen X also refers to the technology, but really it's a specific replacement chemical. And sometimes these are referred to as short chain chemicals because the thought was if they're shorter chain, they would have less adverse health effects. Another common one is Odona, and there's a chemical name after that as well. Unfortunately, recent studies have shown that even these replacement chemicals or short chain PFAS may also have adverse human health effects. Let's go to the next slide. So what's the EPA been doing in terms of addressing PFAS? Well, in May of 2016, they established what's called a drinking water health advisory level. And they set that at 70 nanograms per liter. And nanograms per liter is the same as parts per trillion. That's a pretty small number. And to give you an example of parts per trillion, if you'd have filled the Rose Bowl full of water, that's with all fans, of course, in the Rose Bowl, and with a pure substance and mix that thoroughly, it would be in parts per trillion. And EPA looked at the time available literature, health studies on this, and they based this health advisory on a combined concentration of both PFOA and OS, and includes the most sensitive populations with a margin of protection from lifetime exposure from this. Health advisories, Nick? Yes.
Could you repeat your Rose Bowl analogy? Because the sound cut out on a very important part of that. So sure. You fill the Rose Bowl with water and you add?
Yeah, just a few drops, you know, 2 to 3 drops of a pure substance. That would be equivalent to parts per trillion.
Thank you.
And that's a really low number, but it just shows the concern for health effects at extremely low levels of this compound. And later on, we'll talk about analytical methods, and you can see why it's a challenge when you're trying to detect something at parts per trillion.
May I ask a question on that analogy real quick as well?
Sure.
So you're saying you fill the Rose Bowl, right?
Right. If the Rose Bowl was full of water.
So the entire thing, we're talking more than just 1 foot, we're talking the whole thing?
The entire thing full of water up to the brim.
Okay.
And if you were to add a few drops of a pure substance and mix it well, that would be equivalent to parts per trillion.
Wow.
So it's a small number. I have another analogy coming up later on about parts per trillion to put this in perspective. So the purpose of the health advisory from the EPA is to provide drinking water agencies information to take steps to address contamination and limit exposure. But we're going to discuss regulatory development in the next few slides. So next slide. EPA has also put together in 2019 an action plan, and there's several elements of this action plan, which includes cleanup, toxics, monitoring, research, enforcement, risk communications. One thing I'd point out is one of the best ways to address contamination by PFAS-related chemicals, if you list them as a toxic compound, you start at the manufacturing of these, you'll have more success in controlling them in the environment. Importantly for the drinking water industry, the EPA is moving forward with developing drinking water standards at this time for PFOA and OS. Next slide. So I put this map together based upon some other slides I'd seen on the internet. And what this depicts is states that have taken action to either develop standards or guidelines addressing PFAS. This is really interesting because you have approximately three dozen states that's taken some sort of action to address PFAS. And this is in advance of the EPA actually setting a drinking water standard. This is very unique. It just shows you the high level of concern across the country. And in red depicts states that have enforceable standards, green, non-enforceable guidelines, and some states depicted in blue are just currently relying upon EPA health advisories. But I will tell you that since I made this map, it's changing almost every week. Some new state is considering guidelines or regulations for PFAS. So it's a rapidly evolving issue across the country. Let's go to the next slide. So these two figures here, they look a little bit complicated, but what I want to point out when I mentioned that you've got about three dozen states that have taken some action regarding drinking water or groundwater guidelines, you look at the graph, it depicts from the far left, 2008 through 2020 on the bottom axis, and the side axis is guidance concentration. What I want to show here is that the range of concentrations for OA and OS vary dramatically from state to state. You might ask, well, how can that be? They all have access to the same health effect studies. And in large part, it's the way the epidemiologists view the data and come to a conclusion on what they can consider as important health, adverse health endpoints. My observation here is this provides an opportunity for EPA to really gather this information and have a dialogue with various states so they can find value that's consistent from state to state when they develop the regulations. All right, next slide. So what's California doing to address PFAS? Well, they started a three-phase monitoring program called a phased investigative approach. The first phase is monitoring of source water wells near airports, landfills, and known impacted drinking water sources. You may think, well, why near airports and landfills? Well, airports use a firefighting foam, and that foam contains high levels of PFAS. So that's why the state said, let's start with sites that we believe will have the highest concentrations of PFAS. The second phase is discharges from manufacturing facilities. The third phase is looking at wastewater treatment plants. So the sampling's conducted quarterly for 1 year. That started last year. Let's go to the next slide and take a look at some of the results that they found. So this slide here summarizes the monitoring results over three quarters of monitoring. On the bottom are the particular PFAS chemicals that were detected during the monitoring study. The other axis shows detects, that's the number of times they were detected during this monitoring. So which of the PFAS were the most common? There's about eight or nine that were the most common. You see PFOS, there's also PFHXS, there's PFOA, and the list goes on down to IDANA, which is the substitute and replacement chemical. But this is, again, I want to highlight the fact that they selected sites likely to have high concentrations of PFAS.
Dr. Stern, I'm sorry, is this California or is this the United States? Or?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, this is California. This is part of their phase investigative testing.
Thank you.
Yeah, these are wells across the state of California. That they collected data since last year, and this is what they have found. And the blue is the first quarter, orange is the second quarter, and the gray colored is the third quarter. Consistent, you know, from quarter to quarter. Some of these sites were sampled multiple times. That's why the numbers don't exactly add up to the number of wells tested. Anyway, let's go to the next slide. So So how about guidelines? What's California doing to address this in terms of early regulatory development? Well, in 2018, they established something called notification levels, and they set PFOA at 14 parts and PFOS at 13 parts per trillion. And then in August of last year, they revised those notification levels to 5.1 and 6.5 parts per trillion for OA and OS respectively. But just exactly what is a notification level? Well, it's a health-based advisory level, somewhat equivalent to what the EPA uses. But what happens if you exceed that? So notification levels are not drinking water standards, but if they are exceeded, and if you're a wholesale water system, you're required to notify your governing bodies and water systems directly supplied with that drinking water. Retail agencies must notify their governing body. So in other words, a water agency would have to, if they detected it, would need to tell their governing body, if that's a city council or a board of directors or whatever their governing body consists of. And you're also required to notify your customers via the annual consumer confidence report. So that's what a notification level is. Let's go to the next slide. They also established something else called a response level. In the July 2018, the state of California established what's called a response level. They set it at 70 parts per trillion for the combined level of OA and OS. And then this year, they revised that response levels of 10 PPT for OA and 40 for PFOS. So how does a response level differ from a notification level? Well, this is a health-based advisory level. Again, it's not a drinking water standard, but it does require action from utilities. If the response level is exceeded, then the state would recommend that you remove the water from service or provide treatment or blending until quarterly monitoring demonstrates you're below the response level. So that's a response level. That's how it differs from notification. The response level is asking the agencies to take more direct action. Let's go to the next slide.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes. If I may.
The Regional Control Board change the standard? Is there a reason for that? I mean, they did it. They proposed a combined standard now. Why is that? Was there reasons for that?
Yes, the response level, similar to notification level, those values are determined and provided by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. So as they continue to review available human health effects data, they revise those numbers based upon current data and their interpretation of what that data means for human health. And so they started with 70 parts, they meaning the state of California, which paralleled what EPA recommended, but the Office of Health Hazard Assessment in California, which is, that's their toxicologist and epidemiologist, looked at the data and said, we need to revise this downward based upon our interpretation of health effects data, and that's how they came up with the 10 and 40 parts.
Do you feel that they might further be revised?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
Do you feel that they might be further revised?
That's always subject to ongoing review as more health effects data becomes available. It's the prerogative of OEHA to continue to review available health effects data, and if they feel it's necessary, they'll act upon that. So in this slide here, what if you're not able to remove the water from source or immediately implement treatment, which is the case where a lot of agencies are confronted with levels of OA or OS above response level. So you're certainly required to notify your governing body, but you're required to notify your customers through a number of actions you'll see in the sub-bullets there. But basically, most utilities that are above response level are taking very active measures to address contamination of OA or OS and their water systems. Some agencies have removed wells from service, others have done blending, and others have implemented treatment or a combination of all three. So effectively, a response level is a call to action for water utilities. Next slide. So on this slide here, I plotted the occurrence based upon the monitoring in California for the first three quarters relative to notification level and response level. The upper left part of the figure depicts the number of detects of PFOA and the investigative studies for the first three quarters. And then the bottom there shows the concentration. So about 74% of the samples collected during the first three phases of monitoring were actually lower than the notification level. 8% were above the notification level and 18% were above the response level. And again, I want to emphasize, this is based upon collection from sites known or suspected of having high levels of PFOS. The lower right figure depicts similar findings for PFOS. This is not to, you know, underscore the importance of the occurrence of PFOA or PFOS in the state of California, but it just shows many of the wells are below the notification level and many are below the response level. And that's of those wells suspected of being high risk or subject to contamination. Next slide. Metropolitan's also conducted monitoring. We started in 2013. We've done monitoring in 2016, 17, 2019. We'll also conduct a round of monitoring this year. The first two monitoring programs in 2013, 2016, no PFAS was detected. But in 2017, we did detect one particular PFAS, and that one was perfluorohexanoic acid, or PFHXA. And that was detected at 2.8 parts per trillion. And that was just above the reporting limit, or for many of you, the detection limit. So it was right on the borderline. And with a method, it has about a 50% error rate on there. You don't really know, is that a real number or not? But yet we maintained that. And that's why we did follow-up sampling. So in 2019, with a new method, there's 45 different PFAS analyzed in this particular method. We did detect PFHXA again, but it was the only PFAS that was detected. We did not detect PFOS or PFOA on our latest round of samples, but we found PFHXA in source and treated water sites ranging from less than 2 to 6 parts per trillion. You might say, well, why did we detect it in 2019 and not in the earlier years? Well, it's because detection is based upon improved analytical methods. Let's go to the next slide.
So, Dr. Stewart, so that doesn't necessarily mean that the numbers were rising for this. It just means that we were detecting it at a lower level between 2015.
Yes, that's correct. That's my interpretation. The methods have improved, and now we're better able to find these contaminants. So a lot of people have asked, well, is PFHXA really important? It is found as impurity in firefighting foams, water grease repellents. It's not regulated by the EPA or the state of California. And that's in large part due to the fact there's no studies to date that show that it's a significant human health concern. It's not acutely toxic or carcinogenic. There is one state that's considering setting a drinking water standard, but even at that, they're looking at 400,000 parts per trillion. I would also point out that not all PFAS have the same adverse health effects. And this is a good example of one of these here, that it's PFAS, a chemical, but it doesn't seem to have any significant adverse health effects. And also, if you remember the previous slides when I plotted all the detections in the state of California, PFHXA is one of the fifth most commonly reported PFAS in the monitoring. Let's go to the next slide. I just want to comment briefly about drinking water analysis, because for PFAS, this is a really important aspect to consider. Matter of fact, even the sample collection step is critical, because when you're dealing with things at parts per trillion, and given the ubiquitous nature of these compounds out there, you have to take extraordinary measures to make certain that you don't contaminate your sample when you're collecting that. So if you stopped off at a fast food place and had a bag of French fries, that water repellent chemical on the cover can actually find its way into your sample. Even some of the pins that you use to mark the samples with may contain PFAS, so you have to be especially careful so you don't get a false positive. Then you go through a sample prep, and then you put an instrument called an LC-MS-MS. It's a pretty expensive instrument to get the results. So this takes several days, unlike the TV shows where they run out and grab a sample and you have the results after the commercial. This takes a lot of prep time and really sensitive method. And if you look at the table to the, from the bottom left there, this just shows the different methods over the years. And to the show in the center column, number of PFAS shows how many can be detected. And right now we're up to about 45 different PFAS methods can detect at a range of between 2 and 5 parts per trillion. Previously, I gave an example of parts per trillion. I used the Rose Bowl analogy. Here's another one. How much is 2 parts per trillion? It's about 1 minute in every 2 million years. Someone calculated that. I hope it's correct. It's certainly an impressive factoid. Let's go to the next slide. And of course, one of the common questions is, well, how about treatment for PFAS? EPA recognizes 3 major treatment methods: activated carbon, ion exchange, and membrane separation. These are all relatively effective for removing PFAS. There's subtle differences, maybe not so subtle, based upon the chain length of the PFAS. They have different effectiveness for removal. Most agencies that are involved in treatment use activated carbon ion exchange. Membrane separation is really expensive. But even the other two, you're probably talking several hundred dollars per acre foot. And that price varies considerably based upon the water chemistry you're dealing with and other factors involving capital startup for this. All right, let's go to the next slide. How about legislation? This is a very unique situation. There have been about 42 different PFAS-related bills introduced at the federal level, and it ranges on large from restrictions on the use, waste incineration, a whole host of things. But 8 of these bills are based on drinking water-related, and basically they are addressing regulation by EPA. And even from state to state, previously I mentioned about 3 dozen states have already set guidelines and regulations. This is probably one of the most intensive legislative and regulatory contaminants we've seen in I don't know how long. It's very unique. California is probably looking to set a drinking water standard maybe by 2023, somewhere in there. So a lot of states are taking action on this, an area of great interest. Let's go to the next slide. So what's the state of California? There's 2 major bills, AB 841. This requires Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment to adopt a work plan, identify risks to human health. That's held in committee. It's probably going to be active this year. The other one's Bernardino Bill, Senate Bill 1056. And that's really looking at the state board to certify methods for testing drinking water and to really get a handle on the analytical side of what's going on with PFAS. Let's go to the next slide. Finally, the summary slide. I know Tom's been giving me the eye over like, are we wrapping this thing up? And we are. This is a summary. So basically, PFAS occurrence is widespread throughout the United States. Regulation will be a high priority for EPA, state of California, and quite frankly, all the states in the country. And water agencies with PFAS supplies are confronted with significant challenges. And again, I reiterate, they're considering taking wells offline, treatment, blending, or combination of all 3, and in many cases, this could be a significant economical challenge. But there's still considerable information required to develop drinking water standards. And as I said previously, not all PFAS have adverse human health effects. So that, and you've got 7,800, about 8,000 of these chemicals. As you can imagine, health effect studies are ongoing, but most of these we have no idea in terms of their human health effects. There's still progress being made in treatment. There are some advanced treatment methods being discussed. analytical methods continue to be refined and improved. And the final bullet I added in here because communication is so important with the public in terms of our understanding of this issue. As a matter of fact, Metropolitan, if you look at our website, we have an FAQ and some other information on PFAS. But if you search the internet, you will find just an amazing amount of information on PFAS in terms of fact sheets. But Metropolitan's also prepared that for assistance with our member agencies and for the public. Thank you for enduring with me during the presentation. It actually, I didn't lose you, I don't think. So at this time, I'll turn it back to Tom if there's any questions.
Yeah, President Chavez, I wanted to first open this up to see if any of the board members had any questions. I'll turn it back over to you, and then we can open it up to the public.
Thank you. So, directors, do we have any other comments that you'd like to share? Yes, Director Fellow.
Yeah, this is really mostly for, from what we just heard, I'd like to ask Tony Zampiello, from the basic statement he said, it appears from Tony's comment that there is a major problem in the San Gabriel Valley. And I was just wanted to ask him how serious is it, he thinks, and what methods he will recommend.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. No, I, first off, what I was trying to point out is that I wanted the board to be clear that Watermaster's been involved in looking at this for over 2 years. We did, and through the Basin Water Management Committee, when you go back to Mick's slide that had the phase one of the potentially exposed wells needing to be sampled, those purveyors came to us as Watermaster because we do all the other water quality sampling in the basin and asked us if we would take a programmatic approach to sampling their wells. Watermaster put money in the budget last year. We did sample the 26 wells that were identified by the health department. And actually, the results that we got of the 26, there were about 4 wells that were impacted for these constituents. And the good news is that they were all being treated by one of these methods that Mick pointed out so that their consumers were never exposed. So now we've done a second sample of those, and we haven't seen any surprises in the second samples. In other words, the wells that had it in them the first time did have it. And again, that's 4 of the 26. And then in the memo, what I wanted to point out was that we have estimated what it would take for 4 quarters to sample, if we're required to do all 160 wells in the basin. In the discussions that Steve and myself had with the health department prior to, this was in February, so prior to all of this focus on corona, what the health department indicated to us is they were preparing additional letters, that additional sampling would happen based on some expanded criteria that may include criteria such as if your neighboring wells are impacted, you need to sample. We do know that I won't say a majority, but some of the producers have been proactive on their own. But the samples that are in the memo that I'm going to give the board and the results and the names of those wells are only the ones that have been reported and are on the health department site. So, you know, what we found is Central Basin, Orange County, those two, because they have been taking one form or another of the thought is, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, they've been taking some form of partially treated recycled water for many years. We're seeing a much higher occurrence in those basins. Now, whether that's the sole correlation, it takes people like Mick that are smarter than me to figure that out. But the big difference we see with the main basin and the difference going forward, if we were to take the Carson Project water, is it's fully treated. those treatment trains, and Mick can correct me, would handle these known constituents. So even if we were to take that water, start taking it into the basin, we wouldn't be at risk like them. But when you look at the Santa Ana River, there's been recycled water that's been a part of that flow for many years. You look at Central Basin, since almost past, right after World War II, the San Jose Creek and other plants have been replenishing that basin. And it seems to be, there are a couple of producers there that we've been in contact with that are there. They have to go to treatment right away. I mean, you know, the option is given to say, oh, well, you could send a letter to your constituents, but I think the last thing you want to do to your customers is send a letter saying, you know, we're serving you the water and you probably got this thing in it. So,
yeah. But Tony, that's a good point. And the doctor today made a good, his last point was communications with the public. And as soon as you and Tom think it's appropriate or when we should be on top of it with the public and particularly the city councils, getting the message out, whatever that will be.
And we, is my mic on?
Yeah, you're good.
You know, one of the things I want to point out is we've gotten letters and I've put them in the board packets where the one that comes to mind is California American Water sent a letter to Watermaster as quote unquote one of their governing bodies saying what they were doing with one of the impacted sources and so forth. So if you remember that process there, part of the very first step is notifying your governing board. So what I will do going forward is I will make sure that if those letters are in the board packet, as a minimum, I'll point them out to the board at the meeting. Now, the reason that I didn't go and just distribute that memo, one is that we just really finalized proofreading it, in all fairness. But the other was, some of you will have wells in your areas, whether it be the appointed members to Watermaster or the upper district. And I felt the appropriate way to do that was to let you all know first instead of it coming up the other direction. So I think what I will do instead of waiting, because if you remember, we have a later Watermaster meeting this month, 1 week later, I will get our staff on getting those memos out to you and the managers of the districts within the next day or so, so that you've got a heads up. It really, it's a small sampling, but they are wells that are deemed to be more vulnerable than others. So the good news is that the impact so far doesn't seem to be that great. The other thing, like I say, I'm pretty sure that a lot of the producers have a handle on their sources. The big question is going to be, you know, it's like when we first found VOCs and perchlorate and all of that. If you wanted to do some of these graphs, Dr. Stewart did, you know, you could show in 1 week the number of impacted wells at a certain action level or MCL being 10 wells, and then all you have to do is change it a little bit, and it could jump up to 100 wells. So the biggest thing we need to right now is to find out where this is all going to land as far as what the I shouldn't say the biggest thing, but one of the big factors is where the final requirements are going to land.
Well, thank you, Tony, and thank you, Dr. Stewart, and thank you, Tom, for bringing this important subject to us today. Thank you.
Yeah, and Director Fellow, in answer to your question about the public outreach, this has come up, and we've discussed this at the COG Water Committee. And in fact, the COG staff did send out a notification of this presentation this morning to the COG Water Committee, and I believe some of them may be listening in as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other directors? Santana?
Thank you. That was really a great presentation. I want to thank you, Dr. Stewart. That was amazing. What is your PhD in?
Actually, I went to UC Irvine. It's a program of social ecology and environmental analysis, but my background's all in microbiology. My bachelor's degree, master's, so it's, and my doctorate work was in bacterial resistance or drinking water disinfectants. So pretty exciting stuff, right?
Yes, I think so. I do. I wanted to ask, in regards to, communicating with the public, I know one of the biggest things that we are aware of as a public is the Teflon and the PFAS from that. Is there a specific type that comes from Teflon? Do we know? Or?
Well, Teflon itself is a specific type of PFAS. It's been phased out, and now what the companies are using, and I had a slide in the previous presentations, I had a picture of a pan with a coating on there using a different type of PFAS. Matter of fact, the advertisement said now without PFOA. And so they're using substitute or replacement chemicals that have the same properties as Teflon. But Teflon's basically not being used in cookware anymore.
Great. And do we know from what year they stopped using it?
What year they stopped using Teflon? Probably, I'm going to be wrong on this. I don't know. They probably phased it out starting in 2000 when they had the voluntary phase out program.
Okay.
As to what year they finally stopped producing it, I'm not sure.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you.
Hey.
Thank you. Any other directors wishing to comment?
Dr. Stewart, thank you for being here. We finally got it done, and I appreciate you coming and giving us this presentation.
Great. Thank you.
President Chavez, just to make sure, I'm going to unmute those on the phone briefly to see if they have any questions or comments. And those others who are on Zoom, if you do have a comment or a question, you please use the hand raise feature. Just give them a few seconds.
So anyone wishing to add to our comments may do so at this time.
Hi, this is Chris Lightrup, council member in Bradbury.
Yes.
The 70 parts per trillion lifetime health advisory, does that mean if you drink it at 69 parts per trillion your entire life, you're within their range, or what does lifetime advisory mean?
Yeah, it's a, okay. When they look at health effects and epidemiological work, and I'm no epidemiologist by any means, the way this is done, they assume if you drink, for example, 2 liters of water a day for 70 years, that you'll have X amount of risk of having an adverse health effects from that. So it's a statistical epidemiological derived number. There's no really bright line that says, okay, at year 69, you're safe, or you have 69 parts per trillion, you're great, and at 70, you fall ill. It's more of a statistical extrapolation with how they do that.
And one other question on what contribution would Teflon have had in this part of the world? Or is that not in to our water problem? Is that a Teflon source or something else?
If the question you're asking is what did we detect in terms of PFAS in water, it wasn't Teflon. It was if you look at the list, at least from the 3/4 of monitoring from the state, Teflon was not one of them. It was PFOA, OS, and 8 others that were identified on that one graph.
Dr. Stewart, if you could elaborate a little bit on that. So I think it's important to recognize that the source of the PFAS in our environment isn't just through water. This is just one portion of our exposure. The fact that we, for years, used Teflon pans, and when you're in college, you don't use the plastic spatula, you use the metal one. And so we all had our scrambled eggs. We all have this in our bodies through various sources, not just water. I think it's important to recognize it's prevalent in the environment. The stain resistant sprays, the stain resistant materials they put on carpets, clothing, and other things. It's these chemicals are pretty extensive in our environment.
That's a good point, Tom, because a lot of the exposure came from food wrappers. Air deposition is really important. That's how most of this gets in circulated broadly. And even for Teflon pans, I did a little research on that on the internet. Turns out you really have to heat up that pan to a high temperature before the Teflon's released. But nevertheless, that's why they got rid of Teflon pans. But you basically have to just try to find Teflon release. So most of our exposure is from wrappers, food products that was wrapped in that, and just fabrics that people use and that's waterproof, a whole host of commercial products And that's where most of the stuff comes from.
Thank you. Any other questions from the general public? Then seeing none, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Stewart, for giving us a wonderful presentation. This is a relatively new subject for many of us, but unfortunately it's gonna be a subject that we're gonna be talking about for many months to years to come as well.
Right. Well, thank you, President Chavez, members of the board, and Tom for inviting me to join you today. It's kind of nice to talk about something other than the pandemic. And even the fact that I got to put on a suit today. I mean, that's kind of, I haven't done that in 5 weeks, but thank you for inviting me. And if you have any follow-up questions, Tom has my contact information. I'd be happy to respond to any further questions after this.
Thank you. You're always welcome at the Upper District. Again, thank you once again.
Thank you.
All right. Directors, we'll continue on the agenda, and we'll go to item number 8, informational items. Those are within your packets, and you may read those at your leisure. We'll go to item number 9, attorney's report, Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got to pull up my my list. Okay. Yeah, a few things to report on the transactional matters. We performed a fair amount of work for the district, including working on the standby charge resolution and also some issues concerning the building purchase. We were also researching a potential conflict issue that was raised at a recent Water Master meeting. We were engaged in researching that issue right now. And the primary issue I wanted to bring to the board's attention was we have reached a conclusion to the negotiation of fees in the LADWP versus Metropolitan matter. This was the case that involved the San Diego Union Tribune's request for information from Metropolitan concerning names and addresses of those participants in Metropolitan's turf removal program back in 2015. As you know, this has been a subject of several discussions amongst the board. Went to trial, went to the Court of Appeal, and essentially our side, along with LADWP, Foothill, and West Basin was unsuccessful. We've fully negotiated the fees, costs, and interest at the amount of $43,786.95. So I'm working with district staff to get that check out and tie this up and put this matter to bed. That's the extent of my closed session report. Excuse me, my attorney report.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for our attorney? If not, then we'll go to item number 10, which is our general manager report. Mr. Love.
Just quick update on the office status. We do continue to work remotely to the extent possible. And those who are in the office, we're maintaining appropriate social distancing. Productivity is being maintained, I'm happy to report, and continues. In terms of upcoming meetings, we do have a meeting of the Finance and Admin Committee tomorrow, Thursday. That agenda has been posted. The primary topic of the agenda will be the first workshop with the committee on the consolidated fiscal year 2021 budget. And just want to make sure everyone who is on, listening in, are aware that that will occur via Zoom meeting tomorrow afternoon. And that's all I have, unless the board has questions.
Any questions from directors? If not, then we will move to item number 11, which is director's comments itself. So we'll begin with Director Santana.
Thank you. I think that Upper District has been doing a really great job with these Zoom meetings. I know this is brand new for everyone, and it's just great to see that it's still a very engaging meeting. And I think that's really wonderful. Also, I had a, I was reading the informational items this time that are in the packet, and there were some really interesting ones about mega drought and all these other issues that we might be facing down the line that are kind of scary. And I saw we had a couple of quotes in there from Watermaster and some others. But yeah, there's we're dealing with this coronavirus right now, but there are definitely some more things on the horizon, unfortunately, to be thinking about. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to Director Fellow.
Thank you. You know, today I wanted to talk to you about some information I received yesterday. I don't know if you received it from the United States Senate. Senator, I think it's Basario from North Dakota, who's been very close to Upper District. We've met with his office many times in Washington. But, and maybe Patty had got this information, but it disappeared from my phone. But it's some, it's talking about the legislation in the United States Senate that's dealing with water. And it's bipartisan. The two the Democrats and Republicans are working very closely on this in the Senate. It's some good stuff. Patty, did you get it?
Thank you, Director Fellow. Yeah, I believe you're referring to an announcement that came out, I believe it was yesterday or the day before, regarding a bipartisan deal that was reached between the two chambers. So I can't really talk off the top of my head on all the details of it, but I can forward you and all the directors the email that kind of summarizes the agreement that was reached by both.
Yeah, I wanted to send it to all the directors, so thank you, Patty. Okay. I thought it was very good, very hopeful, some great legislation by both parties, and so thank you, Patty.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you, Ed.
All right, we'll go to Director Trevino.
Thank you, Mr. President. I only thing I have to say is I wanted to thank Ruben. I was a little concerned about the Zoom meetings and my being able to do this. And I just want to say that Ruben, thank you for you're helping me with this. That you've done an amazing job facilitating this. Thank you again.
Sure, you're welcome. Thank you.
Any other comments, Trevino?
No, nothing else.
Thank you. We'll go to Director Contreras.
Thank you, Ms. Am I muted or unmuted? I don't know anymore.
No, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Anyway, my comments will go to the general manager after the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. And then I have nothing to comment about other than, again, thank Dr. Stewart for his presentation. And I'm just wondering, once this information gets out to the public, what that would do to the demand of bottled water. As you know, with the corona virus going on right now, the shelves are low, as are supermarkets at Walmart and Costco, and bottled water is one of the most popular things to purchase. So just being aware of the concerns of the public. Definitely they need to be notified as well, though. Other than that, hopefully everybody's doing well. I want to ask the attorney, is there any reason to go into closed session today?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, as far as board comments, that will conclude that. We'll go to item number 12, which is future agenda items. Does anyone have any items that they wish to present to the board?
I do have one. Yeah. It came up in the Government Affairs Committee meeting. We had talked about possibly doing something, and this might already be in the works, on the Bay Delta. An update on that. Tom, do you have any, is this something that's in the works, or is this still need some more discussion?
No, that's something that we'll look for an appropriate committee meeting. I believe we will start through your committee meeting to have that discussion. But there are some activities going on and some, I will say, slow negotiations between the state administration and the federal administration over operations in the Delta that could have some significant impacts and many other issues in the Delta that we can make the board aware of. So that is in the works. We do plan to bring that in the very near future through the Government Affairs Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. President, I just wanted to say, you know, at the last meeting, I asked for a future agenda item dealing with some comments Tony Zampiello made to the hearings that Congresswoman Grace Napolitano had. And I just want to thank him. He cleared it all up for me, and now I'm very pleased with what's going on, and well, we don't have to take that up. So thank you, Tony. Thank you, Ed.
No problem. Okay, we'll dispense with item number 12. Item number 13, our attorney says we do not need to go to closed session, so we'll dispense with that item as well. And then we'll go to item 15. So, General Manager Love, there's no more business that the board needs to interact with?
No, that concludes business from staff side.
Okay, then that should do it, board. Thank you for your participation. Thank you to the audience, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Take care, everyone. Good morning.